This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world.
As if we weren't already there, join me in an attitude of prayer. Mystery of many names, mystery beyond all naming. This morning we wish to think about and discuss the possibility that we are whole and complete right now, right this minute. This morning we wish to let go of the burden of self-improvement, realizing that all that self-help minutiae is but an attempt for authority to tell us once again that we are not right, we've never been right, and we better get with the program. Hogwash. There isn't a thing we need that we don't have right now. Thinking that we lack something is simply the ability of our own minds to imagine there's something out there that will be better than whatever it is inside here. The grass is always greener is in fact propaganda of the advertising moguls. In truth, the grass is always grass. Our lives look different to us because we are into judgment, and we see in others the chance that their lives are not tangled skeins. But the truth is, if we were able to walk in their shoes and really be them, we would be looking back at ourselves thinking how together we seem now that we're the other. The problem is we're looking to be served when in truth we need to be looking for opportunities to serve. One of our members, Monty Newton, traveled to Nicaragua this past week as a birthday present to himself. No, he did not travel to a remote resort where we sat in wicker chairs with tall drinks garnished with umbrellas. No, Monty traveled to a small village where, with a group of other spiritually minded people, they dug a well for a village. And the emails that he sent back to Nell, his wife, and his children, Lulu and Henry, although garbled by the non-familiarity of the Spanish keyboards, were, nonetheless, filled with a renewal of spirit that is taking place in Monty because he knows what Gandhi knew. To serve is to rule. Forgive us, Great Spirit, as we seem to spend the majority of our time worried about who's going to give us our next jolly. Forgive us for stopping at the traffic light and not giving that dollar to that homeless person. Oh, they're just going to spend it on alcohol, we think. But what we're really saying is that if we were homeless, we'd take the opportunity to lose ourselves in booze. Now lift us up, Great Spirit. Help us realize that the majority of problems in our lives are self-created and can be self-cured. In truth, the self that we hope to improve is, in the Buddhist sense, non-existent. We are all simply witnesses of this life, and all the trauma and drama of our lives is nothing more than adult tempered tantrums that we've not been pleased, not been fed what we think we need. Wake up. We've got it all and always have had it. We pray this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen. I have one reading this morning. It's from James Agee's wonderful book, Death in the Family. On the rough, wet grass of the backyard, my father and mother have spread quilts. We all lie there, my father, my mother, my uncle, my aunt, and I too am lying there. First we are sitting up, then one of us laid down, and then we all laid down on our stomachs or on our sides, on our backs. They've all kept on talking. They're not talking much. Talk is quiet, of nothing in particular, of nothing at all. The stars are wide and alive. They seem each like a smile of great sweetness, and they seem very near. All my people are larger bodies than me, quiet, with voices gentle and meaningless, like the voices of sleeping birds. By some chance, here they are, all on this earth. And who shall ever tell the sorrow of being on this earth, lying on quilts, on the grass, in the summer evening, among the sounds of night? May God bless my people, my uncle, my aunt, my mother, my father. Oh, remember them kindly in their time of trouble and in the hour of their taking away. After a little, I'm taken in and put to bed. Sleep, soft smiling, draws me to her. And those receive me who quietly treat me as one familiar and well-beloved in that house. But will not, oh, will not now, not ever, but will not ever tell me who I am. I've been married a total of 3 times. I jokingly say that my first marriage was my starter marriage. But the truth is, a part of me still loves very dearly the mother of my only son, Ian. The first marriage lasted 5 years. The second lasted 12, 6 drunken, 6 sober. The sober ones were great. I've been married a third and hopefully final time for 20 years so far. There is a sense in which I wanted the women I've lived with to tell me who I am, but they will not, oh, will not. Not now, not ever, but they will not ever tell me who I am. The notion of romantic love that suffuses this culture and many other cultures clouds our vision when it comes to what love is, what it can be, and who exactly it is that is playing this love game. We are encouraged to imagine that we will find a partner in this life who is a soulmate, someone who will be the other half of us, someone who will complete us in some mystical manner. I see this in the faces of those young couples who come to talk to me about getting married. I hear this in the vows that they write, both when they give them to me and when they say them in the ceremony before relatives and friends. Yet I don't have the heart to even attempt to tell them something that rightfully they can only learn by living it. Romantic love isn't an aberration. It's merely the species' guaranteed way to get us to reproduce and keep the species going. Romantic love is part of growing up, and those who don't get past it often fall victim to its seductive lure, its ability to make us think that the right man, the right woman is right around the next corner and that we can't give up on the chance that we will be fulfilled. Between my second and third marriages, I was actually single for a whole 2 years. It beats the 2 weeks I was single between my first and second marriages. I moved from Tallahassee, Florida to Dallas, Texas, where my plays were being done at Theater 3, and I spent the first year in Dallas taking the Greyhound bus back and forth between Dallas and Tallahassee in order to see my daughter. I did that 7 times. I think I could drive that route. During the first summer of our divorce, I went back to Tallahassee to spend some time with Isabel, my daughter, and I was staying with her mother and her girlfriend, and I was sleeping on the couch of a very big homemade home in the Tallahassee Land Co-op. The founder of Mad Dog Builders, Mad Dog Construction Company, had built the home, and it was a wood frame, 3 stories high, a large screened-in porch on the front. Out in the woods west of town, it was serene and beautiful, with the Spanish moss hanging off the live oaks and small dirt roads that wound around the beginning of a hippie culture that was beginning to acquire money. One night, sleeping on the couch, I dreamed I met my anima. I'd been reading a lot of Carl Gustav Jung, and I was intrigued by the idea that we each have the male and female parts of our psyche. It's just that most of us don't realize it. I don't remember what she looked like, but I do remember her name. She told me her name was Amanda. I woke up the next morning and looked through the books in the house and found one of those baby naming books. And Amanda means, my goodness, worthy of love. I thought it was interesting that in a house dominated by women, My second wife's girlfriend had three daughters, and then there was my daughter. I found it interesting that I was the only male in a house of juveniles and lesbians. I imagined on some level that it had been some sort of defense mechanism to actually have identified and met my feminine side in such an unbalanced situation. I thought that she'd come to the surface. Amanda had come to the surface to my consciousness to introduce herself, then simply slip back into the waters of oblivion. How mistaken I was. An irresistible force is a force that impinges upon us without us even being aware of it. Such was the case of Amanda. She had surfaced and she wasn't going away. It wasn't that I changed immediately that would have brought my attention to her presence. It was more like she insinuated herself into my life. And where Jack once stood, now there stood two of us, Amanda and Jack, both comfortable in the same body, both with their own agendas and only so many hours in the day. Jung said that, quote, the discussion of the sexual problem is the somewhat crude beginning of a far deeper question, namely, that of the psyche of human relationships between the sexes, end quote. It just might be that the relationship between the sexes is something that happens not outside of us, but inside of us. In Chinese philosophy, and especially the I Ching, we have the possibility of representing this relationship between the sexes in the yin-yang principle. Within the yin-yang design, the larger part of yang is supported by the thinner yin element, and the larger part of yin is being intruded upon by the thin probing line of the yang, each blending into the other so that the greatest strength of one is actually the beginning of the next. Go too far yin, you get yang. Too far yang, you get yin. And Jung's foreword to Richard Wilhelm's translation of the I Ching, he reminds us that the Chinese mind seems to be exclusively preoccupied with the chance aspects of events. What we call coincidence seems to be the chief concern of this peculiar mind, and what we worship as causality passes almost unnoticed. We must admit that there is something to be said for the immense importance of chance, for in this Western culture, an incalculable amount of human effort is directed to combating and restricting the nuisance or danger represented by chance. In a dream, I chanced upon a meeting with a hypothetical part of myself, known in Jungian terms as the anima. To sleep, perchance, to dream, there lies the rub. In Italian, anima means soul. In musical notation, it appears in the phrase con anima, meaning that the music should be played with soul. It's a chance occurrence that I should find the meaning of this Italian word, but it would seem to suggest that a man who lives without acknowledging his anima or feminine side would, in fact, be a man who was without a soul and who would live a life sans anima, he would be living a life played without soul. It's possible that the whole romantic love thing is really the acting out in public of a drama that should be happening on the inside. Men and women are looking for each other's halves out there in the world, the very place where their other half only exists in the projections from themselves. In the song Both Sides Now, Joni Mitchell sings, I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down and still somehow. It's clouds, illusions, I recall. I really don't know clouds at all. I'm thinking now of the James Agee piece I read at the beginning. I see the family lying on their quilts, but it's summertime, it's daytime. The clouds are billowing overhead. Anyone who's ever done this knows the next step is seeing the configurations of the clouds as they resemble different animals, objects, and shapes. But the shapes are in motion, moving, roiling up there at 30,000 feet. And as fast as we can name them, they morph into another shape and yet another shape. Believing in romantic love is like having a picture of a cloud that at one point in time, assume the shape that we named soulmate. The picture will always resemble the shape we named because within the picture we have stopped the process of the clouds changing. We have frozen time and decided that this is what love always looks like. In her book, Everyday Zen, Charlotte Joko Beck writes, the nonsense of emotion thought dominates our lives, particularly in romantic love. Emotion thought gets really out of hand. I expect my partner that he should fulfill my idealized picture of myself. And when he ceases to do that, as he will before long, then I say, the honeymoon's over. What's wrong with him? He's doing all the things I can't stand. And I wonder why I'm so miserable. My partner no longer suits me. He doesn't reflect my dream picture of myself. He doesn't promote my comfort and pleasure. None of that emotional demand has anything to do with love. As the pictures break down, and they always will in a close relationship, such love turns into hostility and arguments. So if we're close from time to time, we're going to be in pain because no relationship will ever suit us completely. There's no one we will ever live with who will please us in all the ways we want to be pleased. So how can we deal with this disappointment? Always, we must practice getting close to experiencing our pain, our disappointment, our shattered hopes, our broken pictures. We must observe the thought content until it is neutral enough that we can enter the direct and nonverbal experience of disappointment and suffering. When we experience suffering directly, the melting of the false emotion can begin and true compassion can emerge. The way, it seems, to true love and compassion is through endurance and suffering. We can long for that soulmate or grieve their passing, but staying stuck in that loop in which we're sure if we kept looking, then we would have all those hyped up feelings that love is supposed to be all about just keeps us in a neurotic cycle. Jung again. Neurosis is always a substitute for legitimate suffering. I've looked at love from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow. It's love's illusions I recall. I really don't know love at all. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. It's always protects, it always trusts, it always hopes, it always perseveres. Love never fails. If that doesn't sound like the love we've been dealing with, then maybe we've taken a picture of what we thought love should be. Maybe we're involved in idol worship. Maybe, just maybe, we don't know what the hell love is. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought as a child. I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man-woman, I put childish ways behind me. Perhaps now is the time to begin wooing your real soulmate, that half of you that you've refused to cultivate. Shadow selves are called shadow selves not because they're evil or bad or lurk in the dark, but because we've kept them in the shadows, because we've refused to acknowledge them. Tears and fears and feeling proud to say I love you right out loud. Perhaps the I love yous need to be said to the other half of our psyches. You see, Sigmund Freud stood on the shoulders of the Hasidic Jews when he suggested that to become whole we must rescue from the darkness that spark of divinity which lies buried within us. Sometimes to become whole we must dig a hole, an earth, unearth what we find, resurrect that part of ourselves that we've been projecting into the world. Amanda, my dear, I want to say right out loud that I love you, that together Jack and Amanda are truly worthy of love. Thank you, Amanda, for helping me to stop projecting onto those females about me the mantles of Madonna, the mantles of whore. Thank you for helping me to see that to become whole, I must not only be strong but also supportive, nurturing, that I must see that it's not always right to be aggressive, but there's time for retreat and regrouping. But mostly, thank you for helping me see that the true birth of anything takes a period of gestation, a period in which that which is incumbent and unformed must grow inside me till the moment of its birth. And once birthed, I must let go and let grow the seeds and plans that I've left behind me. And now I will sit down from this pulpit a last time. From the bottom of both of our hearts, which happens to be the same heart. Amanda and I thank you for the journey well spent. We give thanks for your gifts of compassion and love, and pray that in the years to come, this congregation will grow and continue to grow as it has in the past into a loving and nurturing body wherein those so covenanted find solace and grace. As it was in the beginning, it is and ever shall be, congregation without end. Amen.